This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Being a patient is to be part of a professional environment with no requirements to be professional oneself. It is, I found, intensely satisfying to make doctors laugh. It's one of the few consolations of losing one's eyesight. You can, without guilt, contemplate buying some really good speakers to listen to Purcell on. You can occasionally afford first-class train travel. And there's the chance to experience a lot of different medicine. When eyesight goes wrong, it can be symptomatic of deeper problems with roots in different parts of the body, as mine probably was, if only we could track them down. My condition had the consolation of leading me into encounters with some fascinating people. A dandyish neurologist who seemed to find everything faintly but delightfully ridiculous. A Buddhist nurse who claimed to get no satisfaction from nursing. And the fabulously, constantly surly keepers of the Goldman and the Humphrey. Two eye tests which seemed innocuous enough to me but clearly drove their owners round the bend. The experience of 21st century medicine is both complex and enlightening beyond the raw business of identifying and managing the underlying condition. The clinic I attended at St Thomas's opposite the Houses of Parliament can call upon the best of everything and everyone in ophthalmology, yet exemplified the facts that medicine is as much art as science, as much human as technical, and as much providence as practicalities. It is easy to forget this if you pay too much attention to how some of the media treats medical science. There are daily breakthroughs in fundamental research that promise to cure this or that. There is disaster when this or that factor is found to cause some terrible outcome. Most of this is, to be kind, oversimplified. While there is plenty of steady and occasionally spectacular progress in understanding and treating many conditions, many others become more complex and less well understood the closer we look at them. Medicine is not linear, and it does not make progress through single discoveries. Mostly, reality is that much of the human body insists on going its own way, often for reasons that cannot be discerned and with outcomes that cannot be determined. Along the way, the patient is accompanied by guides in white coats who know the landscape but often cannot direct the path. Their professional authority can sit uncomfortably with this, although the best are, or can be, disarmingly frank. In having something go wrong with my eyes that defied easy diagnosis and was not to be cured, I was in some ways at one with the experience of most of blind humanity for most of our history. Pre-scientific knowledge of eye anatomy and the progression of eye disease was surprisingly good, due in no small part to the eyes being the easiest of organs to observe before the patient was actually dead. Treatment, however, did not so much lag as not exist. The most comprehensive early European ophthalmology textbook was written by one Benvenutus Grassus, who was probably Italian, probably most active in the mid to late 13th century, and most definitely very modern in his taste for self-promotion. Interspersed with homilies about his own skill and experience, he described 26 conditions of the eye, some of which are familiar today, and gave advice about which ones to treat and which ones to leave alone. The only condition that had any chance of what we'd consider a successful medical intervention was cataracts. Benvenutus identified 7 kinds differentiated by hue and colour, 4 of which could, on occasion, be displaced within the eye through a rather gruesome procedure involving needles and egg white. Otherwise, there were 2 approaches to all blindnesses. Benvenutus's default was to advise various mixtures of poultices, laxatives and dietary restrictions, very much along the lines of take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. The alternative was religion. The church provided miracles through supernatural intervention, which, to the medieval mind, was every bit as likely to work and be as well attested as the medicinal option. Both approaches drew in some part on the reputation of blindness as being caused by gluttony, lust and drunkenness. Abstinence and contrition could thus go some way towards effecting repairs. The converse was also true. There are many tales of villains attempting to steal from churches and being struck blind for their pains. Usually, subsequent repentance returned sight in time for God's grace to be evident, most satisfyingly just before the miscreants were executed. As there was plenty of blindness about, even among those who led blameless lives, the pure of heart, the pilgrim and the prayerful were held to have the best chance of being cured. And this could be most usefully realised by behaving as the priests and monks advised. The marginalia of medieval manuscripts have many sketches of the blind, often recognisable by white sticks and guide dogs, being cured through reliquaries, pilgrimage, saintly intervention and the laying on of hands. Obey, submit and be whole. This approach is by no means extinct in today's medical profession, although it has become far less of a white-coated priesthood than even 30 years ago. I have been patiently lectured on the extirpation of drunkenness and gluttony, or at least their severe moderation, in terms Benvenutus would approvingly recognise. To their considerable credit, the modern medics do not now damn a man for failing to comply, and have jettisoned lust, almost entirely, as a danger to the eyes. Not that my condition, anterior ischemic optic neuropathy, or AION, is much affected by sins of the flesh. There are an alarming variety of underlying conditions that can trigger it, and ruling them out takes a variety of machines, a battery of blood tests, and many different sorts of doctor. I chose, quite consciously, to go through all this almost as one would a fairground, a set of encounters with more or less strange experiences, with more or less strange people at the controls. There will be time enough afterwards to worry about the final outcome. During periods of investigation, it is customary to keep the patient fairly well in the dark. There is little to be gained by knowing you're being tested for multiple sclerosis one day and scanned for tumours the next. My blood was taken and bottled in ranks of test tubes like so many miniature cases of claret, to be tasted by who knows what connoisseurs. I was irradiated by X-rays through a device resembling an enormous sandwich maker on a giant's anglepoise. I was injected with something which may make you feel a bit funny, in the middle of being scanned for half an hour in an extremely noisy, claustrophobic white tube in which staying very still was of the utmost importance. Here at least I was given a choice of radio station to listen to over the intercom headphones. To take my mind off things, I asked for Radio 4, which, as soon as I was fully isolated within the machine, sensed a helpless victim unable to change channels. It delivered a long and relentlessly detailed lecture, as only woman's hour can, about female genital mutilation in sub-Saharan Africa. It is hard to recalibrate one's experiences and thoughts when in the very heart of very loud, very intrusive first-world medical technology, but that did the trick. There is much to be said for being a passive recipient in medical investigation. It assuages the guilt, always present, at taking up a doctor's time on matters that do not directly make you better, when the corridor outside is full of people patiently waiting their turn. And, after you've ruled out the obvious stuff, engaging closely with the possibilities each test covers becomes an exercise in hypochondria, amplified by the knowledge that they think you might have it too. But these days, any remaining role for the priesthood as mystical intercessor has been roundly reformed by Professor Google, and the medical scriptures, although often as hard to hack as Chaucer, are no longer locked up. So, while the initial encounter had the senior consultant saying that it's like your optic nerve is gasping for air, without going into the consequences, let alone any sort of diagnosis, 5 minutes of the smartphone in the waiting room between tests delivered more clinical detail than I would have got from an hour-long lecture. And, by the time I did ask for a prognosis, I'd learned enough to tell that by this time there have been some morphological changes in the anatomy, meant that a chunk of my optic nerve had died off and was not coming back. Ironically, this put me in the position of not wanting to tell the doctors how much I knew, or at least suspected. No matter how well informed we think we are, patients are still supplicants and should remember the fact. The consultant in charge of my case, a splendid woman with no love of political correctness but a deep, if brusque, humanity, reacted with unexpected alarm when I mentioned that I'd Googled her and pulled a couple of the papers she'd written. I modulated my revelations thereafter, but still did my homework. Only up to a point, there's only so much worth knowing about rare side effects for medical procedures. There are many other ironies. The consulting ophthalmology area inside the hospital is perhaps, of necessity, dimly lit, making it hard for the newly impaired to navigate. During the investigation, I was diagnosed with sleep apnea, the condition when you stop breathing at night. This has recently been discovered to be one cause of my eye condition, and, yes, tied to obesity, and thus to that medieval diagnosis of gluttony. Obesity itself retains quite a lot of the medieval in the way it is perceived, diagnosed, and imperfectly controlled. But the clinic in which the apnea was discovered, a place where one is covered in wires and put to bed beneath watchful cameras, is right opposite Big Ben, whose quarterly chimes can provoke a most desperate insomnia. But most of the time is spent in a drab waiting area, watching the other outpatients and wondering. It's here that news is received and conclusions drawn, where there is ample time to reflect on each development and contemplate the possibilities of what the next test may reveal. As one learns the personalities of each of the staff, and they come to remember you, a feeling of complicity, real or imagined, evolves. The modern lifelines of mobile phones, instant messaging, text and email both sustain and, as eyes get worse or the drops kick in, fail when they're needed most. As my condition intensified, I spent a lot of time in that waiting room. There was a brief flurry of activity when the one remaining half-good eye suddenly had an additional attack, completely against the rules. And the slow process of looking for clues was enlivened by an enormous dose of steroids. The consultant didn't really believe in that, describing it as a treatment promoted by a doctor whose approach to the statistics behind it was arguably over-optimistic. I took that as a euphemism wrapped in professional courtesy. That was the only time of true despair, when it seemed as if I would no longer be able to read. I had previously been trying to set up my computer to speak things on screen, just in case things got much worse than expected. But oddly, when it seemed they actually were, I gave up on that. There'd be time to learn later, and I had had enough of staring down my monsters. The final blow did not, and has not yet fallen. Whether the steroids helped, or whether the ineluctable course of my condition just went that way, the second eye stabilised in a messy but workable state. Words are still with me, and we could get on with sorting out just what was going on. As each test came back negative and the consultations got more esoteric, the sense of being drawn into a mystery got stronger and, despite the feeling it wasn't quite appropriate, more exciting. This made the dislocation all the more unnerving each time I left the hospital to return to my flat, where, excused work, I sat out the long months of uncertainty. While at the hospital, despite the inefficiencies of an overworked staff, plenty of hurry up and wait, and a seemingly constant battle to locate my notes in time for them to do any good, there was progress, there are options. There was a complex machine around me, with some grace and purpose in the hands of hard-working, competent and caring people. But, alone, back in my surroundings, the sense of abandonment was strong. That feeling perseveres. The final diagnosis, made with schoolboyish triumph by an intensely senior chap with an aura of almost careless competence and a 30-page CV, yes, the internet again, identified a peculiar bunch of nodules called optic disc drusen, buried deep in the back of the eyes. Drusen have one of the more poetic names in medicine, being called after the German word for geode, those beautiful pockets of quartz crystal that form an igneous rock. Optic disc drusen are mysterious, probably accumulating as lumps of protein and other detritus over a lifetime due to a breakdown in some of the most complicated systems within the nerve cells, the ones it uses to get rid of its rubbish. The discovery of the drusen satisfied my consultant, and for now signalled an end to the chase. "We can't just go in and dig them out," he said, while allowing that he couldn't say what, if anything, would happen next, nor, if it did, when. And that was that. A climax, followed by a lifetime of being just another bloke registered blind with very bad eyesight. There will not be, despite the protestations of friends who've read this or that in the papers, any miracle cure. To fix my eyes, I know, will need three separate major advances, only one of which is currently at the stage of killing mice in laboratories. This, then, is the consolation of engaging with the science with a clear head. To know one's fate is to be able to disregard it, and get on with the practicalities of not being able to count your change, not seeing the bus numbers, and to close your eyes and listen to Purcell with ever more pleasure than before.